I like cake.
You can cut a cake in squares and you'll have yourself four shares. If you cut these squares this way again, you'll have yourself 16. But consider the diagonal way, and then you'll have an equal tray. Four squares are fairly divvied up to eight, and it's so clean.
Okay, so I am here with Neil Stevenson, who is the author of Cryptonomicon, Snow Crash, and most recently, Anathem. Neil, how are you doing?
I'm good. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I will try not to get into this Kefadokles mode that you had mentioned in the book. But okay. First off, I wanted to ask, is there any philosophical precedent for seven being the ideal number of guests at a dinner table? Or was this something that you just stumbled upon through trial and error?
It's trial and error. And I think it's in the book because I think a lot of people will recognize this at some level. If you've ever you know, taking a bunch of people out to a restaurant, you get more than about that number, and people can't hear each other, and they split off into side conversations.
Yeah.
But if you keep it below about there, it's actually possible for everyone to talk about the same thing.
Yeah, yeah. It's also a prime number, too. I mean, did you consider five at any point? Or?
Well, five would have constrained my ability to write that chapter, so I picked seven because I figured that these people have long attention spans and they could probably handle it.
I wanted to ask you about just a general observation, then we'll get into the nitty-gritty of the book. William Gibson's books have shifted from this near future into more of the present, and your own books have gone from the near future to the past. And in this book, of course, you have a parallel Earth, and you're essentially inventing almost a kind of near future with elements of the present. And I'm wondering if this temporal setting has much to do with our current present world, that we can't always keep on top of current technological developments, that this has posed something of a problem for you. Why have you drifted more to the past? Is it more of the philosophical interests and the scientific interests that you have, or is it predicated in some sense upon the now as we speak?
Man, you're asking me to engage in a level of self-reflection and analysis that I just don't know if I'm capable of.
You know, give it a shot.
there's really no plan with this stuff. I wrote Cryptonomicon, which is a World War II book that's mixed with a modern-day storyline. Because I was interested in kind of looking into the history of computers and how computers and information technology have impacted us. And then that led in a completely unplanned way to the Baroque cycle, where I went back 300 years earlier and looked at exactly the same themes. And now I'm back to writing something that looks more like science fiction as we normally define it.
It really is more of just essentially philosophical or temporal. I mean, I'm still kind of wondering why you've drifted more towards the past.
Well, Bill Gibson, who you just mentioned, has said that science fiction isn't really about the future. It's about an alternate present. And the stuff he's been writing the last few years is clearly set in an alternate present. And I think the same thing applies more or less for any of the books that we're talking about here. You can always, if the book's working, you can always find connections between it and the life you're leading today in this world.
Got it. Well, I wanted to also ask you about the many disciplines of thought that the Avowt have within this book. The Skonik group stood out for me in particular because they concern themselves with knowledge that is perceived by the senses, which suggested a kind of empiricism. But this also seemed to me almost Lacanian, because looking into something like Vem space is subject to how one interprets the information in these dialogues that you have with the characters. So I'm wondering if you're suggesting with the Skonik group that how one interprets information is really more subject to the interpretation of the data as opposed to the data itself. Were the various disciplines your effort to suggest this relationship between perception and science?
Well, what I'm doing there is setting up some ideas from the history of thought in this world. Because of the way this book's written, I have to have parallel thinkers working on the same ideas in this alternate world. So what I'm interested in this book is a conversation, or not really a conversation, but a kind of line of thought that developed in the 20th century around largely in the mind of Kurt Gödel. And of course he's well known for what he proved in logic early in the century, but he spent about the second half of his life, really the whole time he was at the Institute for Advanced Study, thinking about metaphysics, thinking about specifically about Platonism, which is the idea that when mathematicians prove something, that they're not just making stuff up, but they're actually perceiving or getting access to kind of pure concepts and ideas that exist on another plane of existence somehow. It's a pretty spooky idea and something that had fallen into disrepute by the time Gödel came on the scene, and he believed in it, though, and was looking for ways to work with it that were rigorous and didn't seem quite so kind of quasi-religious and weird. So this is turning into a little bit of a long story, but he ended up deciding that Husserl was the man. Husserl was a philosopher who lived just a few years before Gödel did, and Gödel felt that Husserl had solved some problems and taken care of some objections that had been raised by Kant. So the Skonics, the fictional philosophers that you're talking about in my book, are basically Kantians. They're basically saying what Kant said, and Husserl came along and found a way to take a new spin on Kant's work that I found interesting and that worked well in this project.
I also wanted to ask you about the units of measurement throughout this book. You have Roz frequently using his hand as a form of measurement. There's also, of course, the pinpricks of light, but the hand measurement reminded me very much of the cubits that you find in Gene Wolfe's books. And, of course, ought seems to me taken from autark. I wanted to ask you about both the units of measurement, but also I know that you used Runcible from Lear, of course, in the Diamond Age. Did you want to have these imprecise units of measurement to suggest a more pure pursuit of knowledge that is somewhat approximate as opposed to exact? And what of these many happy references throughout your books to specific terminology that can be found from other authors?
Well, as far as the units were concerned, that was actually you know, it's a small point, but it's one that I wrestled with because we're used to thinking of people, you know, scientists working in the metric system. So my inclination was to have them talk in terms of kilometers and other, you know, kilograms and other metric units. But when I wrote those down on the page, they kind of jumped out at me as seeming somehow wrong, and I decided to go with more old-fashioned units because my rationale for that is that this book effectively takes place 3,700 years in the future, and so the units of measurement that they're using are going to seem very old and time-worn. They're going to be very old words, mm-hmm. And I wanted to use very old words in the text so that they wouldn't sort of jump off the page and seem kind of modern and high-techy. And then as far as the other references you're talking about, ought comes from auto de fe, mm-hmm. Act of the faith, which is an old term from the from the Inquisition. And what I'm doing in general for these people, for these fictional characters, is trying to come up with a lingo that sounds sort of quasi-Latin, quasi-Greek, with word roots that you can kind of puzzle out if you're familiar with those languages.
Got it. Well, I mean, was Gene Wolfe's Sun books, were these, because there are very similar monastic, there's a similar monastic narrative in both your book and Gene Wolfe's Sun books. And likewise, of course, there's Ridley Walker, Will Self's The Book of Dave, which has an invented vernacular. Although in this case, the vernacular is not so pronounced or as Baroque as those particular books. And one of the striking things about your book, I think, is the fact that, well, one actually becomes very adept with this terminology roughly within 50 to 100 pages. What thought did you place towards this reader interpretation of them being able to understand this terminology so that it becomes second nature? Did you really consider every conceivable term in this that carefully, and also going back to this lineage of speculative fiction books? I mean, and if you did rip off Gene Wolfe, well, I should also point out that he ripped off Jack Vance. So maybe you can talk about these two threads here as they relate to Anathema.
Well, I haven't read the Gene Wolfe books that you mentioned, but now that you've mentioned them, I'll have to go back and check them out. I'm actually a pretty poor scholar of science fiction. Mm-hmm. In general, so I always learn things from talking to people like you who've read much more than I have in the field. In fantasy and science fiction, learning new words is part of the experience. So, I mean, to pick a kind of ubiquitous example, there are millions of kids running around today who know the meanings of words like Horcrux and Wizengamot because they are used in Harry Potter. And when you pick up a new book from fantasy or science fiction, I think seeing those new words on the page is part of your immersion into that world, and that without it, you wouldn't feel as though you were on a different world at all. So people who read this kind of literature, I think get good at kind of blowing past those words. Mm-hmm. And they don't, if you're an experienced science fiction reader, you don't stop and say to yourself, I've never seen that word before, what does that mean? You just kind of file it away in your head, and as the narrative goes on, you sort of figure out what it means, and you become familiar with the world. If you're not used to reading this kind of fiction, it can be a little bit more of a showstopper, and you might want to go back to the glossary and look it up. But what I'm hearing from most people is exactly what you said, which is that it's about 100 pages of getting comfortable with the lingo. Mm-hmm. and then it's all kind of easy from that point on.
But did you have the general reader in mind by including that glossary? I mean, you could have also done away with that, and it would have been more of a mystery. Likewise, the timeline and the Calca and the like, which I thought the Calca were quite fun. But it is nevertheless, just as the book that he has to copy, an increasing level of sophistication as the Calca goes on. And I'm wondering, was the general reader very much a consideration this time around after the Baroque cycle, or what happened here?
Yeah, while I was writing the actual text of the book, I wasn't thinking about those issues at all, because you can't. That's if you're sitting there all the time trying to ponder those issues, it becomes a real impediment to progress. But when people then started reading it after it was finished, I got feedback from some who said that they thought it would be nice to have a glossary. And I hadn't planned on that, but I was happy to go through and make one. And when I did that, I was astonished to find how many words were in it.
Did you keep a running list by your keyboard
no,
for this or no?
No, not at all. And so actually a friend of mine, Jeremy Bornstein, came up with a script, a computer program that went through the entire text of the book and compared every word to a dictionary.
Oh, wow.
And spat out a list of all the words that it didn't recognize.
Yeah.
And I was astonished at how many words I'd invented. And at that point, I agreed that we should have a glossary, but we decided to stick it at the back of the book, not at the front, so that habitual fantasy and science fiction readers who like to just work it out for themselves could just go straight to page one and start reading and not have to wade through this, you know, impedimenta at the front of the book.
Did these words come to you while you were writing the book, or did you plan all this in advance? It seems to me that if you're keeping them in your head, that it was largely an intuitive vernacular that you were concocting as you were writing.
Yeah, there was certainly no plan. Just as I went along, you know, I really began with a very simple idea of these people having the conversation that opens the book. They're sitting in a library. They're talking to somebody who's come in from outside to do some work. And I didn't have much of a structure beyond that. So as the story developed, I had to think out in greater detail, you know, how does this society work? What are their rules? What are their traditions? What are their rituals? And those all spawned new concepts and new words. So it all developed organically.
Going back to the idea of the general reader, or the common reader, whatever we want to call the audience here, the philosophical proposition involving the fly, the bat, and the worm, expressing basic cognitive ability and how cognitive abilities come together to be so that humans are more or a higher form of animal than other animals. This was a very, at least to me anyway, a very clear way of expressing this particular concept of individual senses. And I'm wondering if this was something that you concocted or that you took from Kant, because I actually tried to find a kind of philosophical precedent for this as well.
It's more from Husserl. Mm-hmm. So Husserl was an amazing guy who could just sit in his office and you know, look at a copper ashtray and then write at great length about all of the processes that went on in his mind when he was perceiving that ashtray and sort of recognizing it from one moment to the next as being the same object. And so he's got a number of lengthy books about this, which, as you can imagine, are pretty hard to read. So the content of the sort of dialogue or the parable that you mentioned, the fly, the bat, and the worm, really comes from him, but it's me trying to write kind of a somewhat more accessible version of similar ideas.
Yeah. So you really want it to be accessible in some sense, it seems to me.
In some sense, yeah.
Well, what sense exactly?
Well,
if the reader doesn't matter, and yet at the same time there's this accessibility here, it seems. Well, what's the real story?
Oh no, the reader matters. No, it's got to, the criterion is very simple. It's got to be a good yarn. Mm-hmm. If it's not a good yarn, then the whole enterprise fails. So, yeah, I think that. You know, to have a good yarn, you've got to have characters people are interested in, and they've got to get into situations that make for a good story. It's okay to stop the action and have them sit down and have an interesting conversation. And, you know, I always, for some reason, go back to the movie My Dinner with Andre, which is a long movie consisting of two guys just sitting there talking to each other. But it's a completely engaging and fascinating movie. So you can, that's kind of an existence proof that you can build a good yarn that consists largely of people just having conversations. And so that was kind of my guiding, that was my guideline, I guess you could say, for trying to work that material in.
Did you restrain yourself in terms of exposition or description? I mean, there's a lot of description early on, but through a good chunk of the book, there are huge chunks of the book that are nothing more than this conversation. Was this a self-imposed limit? Was this something that you had learned from previous books or whatnot?
I had learned from previous books that I can... it's very easy to get fascinated with a made-up world and to want to describe it in tremendous detail. And I thought that was sort of a danger to be avoided in this case, because we've got these people going out of their monastery and exploring the outer world. And I could have had endless pages of description of, you know, what their cars look like and what their buildings look like and the geography. And I knew that would be a trap to be avoided. So,
well, speaking of exploring the outside world, the secular world here, there is one lengthy episode in which Roz actually has to make his way across a snowscape, gets into a skirmish. Then, of course, there's a martial arts episode and the like. But it seemed to me almost something of a side quest, because there aren't a lot of ideas in that section. There's not a lot of philosophical dialogue. And I'm wondering if the purpose of this was to, because every grand narrative needs a side quest or needs a kind of little escapade, was this a way of giving the reader a break going through this, or just to show the anti-intellectual nature of the slines and the like? Or,
well, there's not always that much premeditation in these things. I find that thinking about it too hard sometimes is counterproductive. So there is a need for this character to get from point A to point B.
Yeah.
And I suppose I could have just done a jump cut, as we say in the movie industry, but I thought that that depending on how I handled it, it might be an opportunity to convey a little bit more about the world, move the plot along in some ways beyond the merely kind of geographic relocation.
In terms of the humor that is there, particularly early in the book, and particularly in the ideas section, was this a way to amuse yourself or amuse the reader? I mean, even down to the engravers who can't get the how Santa actually comes about, or things of certain kinds of qualities along that actually affect the language. It seems to me a very humorous book, as well as a bit of a cerebral book as well. And so does humor something, I mean, it's been there in your books all along. Is it just something there for you to, I guess, keep the mighty narrative flowing here?
Again, I certainly am not sitting there saying to myself, I haven't written a joke in 7.3 pages, I'd better say something funny now. But I guess it's part of the way I see the world, and it's something that I value in books that I read, books by other people. I love finding humor, particularly in unexpected places, and I think that humor is a thing that people do. It's a human characteristic, and it's a humanizing element of fiction. It gives you the sense that you're dealing with real people and not just made up characters.
Roz, to some degree, is almost the anti-Enoch route, in the sense that he is vulnerable. He's never in the right place at the right time. Was this obverse something that motivated his creation? Or?
No. He and his three buddies, who are kind of the main characters in the book, are really inspired directly by the characters I used to enjoy reading about in Robert Heinlein's young adult novels.
Yeah.
So Heinlein wrote any number of books featuring people of about this age, and it works because everyone's been there or is going there. You know, if you're a 12-year-old, it's interesting to read about what the 18-year-olds are doing. Mm-hmm. And their cluelessness gets them into interesting situations, and in a way gives you gives me as a writer a way to talk about the world. It's by going out and making mistakes and getting into trouble that these people learn lessons, and by reading about those events, the reader can also at the same time learn something about the world in which the book is set.
As Roz moves outside the consent, there is something interesting that happens in relation to his perception of music, which is, again, going back to one of the earlier questions I had. Initially, there's this very fine distinction as to the music that is sang, that the music that the avowed sing in the consent. And then eventually he starts to develop a little bit of an ear for pop music in the fetch. And then by the end, when a major development occurs, and I will certainly try not to spoil things, the individuals then are improvising, and you point out or you write that few noticed and none cared. So music itself is almost this thematic motif that actually sort of changes with things developing within Arbre. I'm wondering what the role of music was in relation to writing this. It seems to come up like almost every couple of hundred pages, not every 7.2 or whatnot, but I did want to ask you about this because it does seem to just change very slowly over the course of the narrative here.
Well, there's been a connection between music and mathematics for a long time, and most of these people are kind of mathematically minded folks. I grew up in a town of scientists and engineers out in the middle of Iowa who managed to support a pretty major symphony orchestra program, bringing in New York Philharmonic and other such groups from all over the world. So that connection's been there for a long time, and I decided early on that it would make sense for these people to have their own very strong musical tradition. They're living under kind of an extreme vow of technological simplicity where they're not allowed to own anything as complicated as a musical instrument. And so they have some bells, but most of their music is made with their voices. They're all a cappella singers, and they've got a tradition of chant that's kind of liturgical. It in a way is kind of analogous to Gregorian chant from our Middle Ages, but instead of being about religious themes, it's about mathematics. And this actually turned into a side project that's been quite interesting, to actually create some of that music with a composer friend of mine named David Stutz. So to me it feels consistent with who these people are and the way they think that music would kind of be their favorite form of art. Mm-hmm. and that going outside into the secular, what they call the secular world, that they would perceive things from that, kind of through that lens, you know, hearing music on the radio of a car. That's something that an avowed is going to focus on when everything else about the outside world might seem incomprehensible or kind of too weird to process. The music is something that might sort of kind of break through to them.
I was also interested because there are a number of double meanings throughout this book, to say the least, but I'll cite two examples. Bullshit, for one. We have the figurative concept of people spouting forth bullshit, and as well as when the spacesuit enters the equation, well, we quite literally see people shitting in their suits. Likewise with Cord. Roz wears a cord, and his sister is also named Cord. And so I wanted to ask you about this notion of a literal and a figurative dichotomy. It's almost as if you're gently nudging the reader into seeing some of the dichotomies that philosophy and even science is built upon.
Yeah, the cord thing is really an accident, and I I considered changing those words because it looked, I was afraid it would look like I was trying to make a pun or an analogy there that I don't think is really there. But I think I'm going to draw a blank on this one.
Okay, no problem. Well, word dichotomy is one of these notions that you were trying to use within the actual frame of the narrative to talk about more of these ideas. We can talk about also domains and the multiverse as well, which I also wanted to ask you about. The fact that you have the polycosm instead of the multiverse, and also you have a complex equation called, Teglon, which seemed to remind me of Max Tegmark's mathematical universe hypothesis.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. Of course, Teglon is, I think it's derived from Greco-Latin word for tile.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a pretty direct take, and it's actually kind of a remarkable coincidence that Max Tegmark has a similar name. He's Swedish, I think. So in his case, the name must come from some other root, but it is a kind of interesting interesting coincidence there.
But there is something also about the notion of multiple domains or multiple universes tied in directly to the concept of the narrative in this book, because here we are in a narrative, talking about a narrative, and so there's this metafictional aspect, which I haven't seen in all of your books for the first time here. One could possibly read it that way, and playing around with this notion, I'm curious as to whether this was a divine accident, so to speak, or whether this was something that you were possibly looking for the perfect universe yourself as you were.
Well, there's a lot of accident in it, or at least it feels like accident to me. But at the same time, you can't write something like this without a little bit of self-awareness. So what you're talking about comes from it's all related to this notion I mentioned earlier of Platonism, of the idea that what people do when they do math is to actually perceive in some sense another world that has things like triangles and numbers and mathematical concepts in it. And so that's a theme that runs through the whole book, and it's kind of hard to get into a lot of detail without spoilers, but it helps to support the many parallelisms that you're noticing between words and concepts on Earth and those on the fictional world where the book's set.
Well, also I wanted to ask you about the distinction between the Aita and the Avowt, because you have at one point Salmon is asked, or some man, or
Saman. How I say it, but I'm not.
I keep thinking some man because but there is something about this that where he's asked whether he has a girlfriend or a woman in his life, and he essentially just basically says, "Oh well, I'm just family based." And this stands in sharp contrast to what is said early in the book, when there are specific types of relationships. They could be two, they could be four, they could be six. That the Avowt are part of, but you never actually specify those types. And I wanted to ask you about this, because it's almost as if the suggestion here that the rift between these two parties has perhaps less to do with scientific differences and more to do with these ethical differences or how they go about their personal lives. And I found that to be quite interesting.
That's an interesting takeaway from the book. I'm glad you mentioned it. I hadn't. It's definitely there. And we don't learn much about the Aita in this book, but the Avowt can smell their cooking if the wind is blowing the right way, and it always seems as though they're cooking something better, more spicier and more interesting than what the Avowt are having. And the Avowt are a kind of social structure that many people would find extremely forbidding. There's basically no, once you go in, you don't have a family. You can't have children. You're not with your biological parents anymore, and so you're being raised by the older male and female Avowt that you've been thrown in with. And that's pretty chilly.
Yeah,
it's certainly and it's certainly a thing. The avowed learn to live with it, and they come out of it okay, it seems. But you can certainly see how people who didn't live under that discipline would look at them askance and think of them as being kind of strange or inhuman.
In her review of this book in the Los Angeles Times, Laura Miller made a very interesting observation, pointing out that this is essentially a campus novel, and this, again, returns to the territory of the Big U. Likewise, it's also the first time you've used first person in a book since
Zodiac.
But I wanted to ask you about why you have avoided the first person, and to what degree Anathem represents a return or a sort of cycle, a new Baroque cycle, so to speak.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't see it as a cycle, but as a decision that gets made case by case with each book. The first person imposes some constraints, and I'm sitting here wondering how many times people can possibly go in and out of that door during this interview. The first person approach imposes some constraints, and constraints in a work of art can be bad and good, right? They make the artist work harder, but they impose structure that can have good results. In this case, I wanted to avoid jumping into a kind of omniscient third-person narration style. I wanted it all seen from the point of view of one person, and you get that automatically by telling it in first person. In the other books you're talking about, those had narrative storylines that jumped back and forth between different people, and so and even between different timelines. So there was little choice but to use the third-person narration in those books.
I also wanted to ask you about something that some reviewers have criticized you with this book in terms of your portrayal of the relationship between Allah and Roz, pointing out that Allah falls into this kind of stereotype of women who are the nurturer or the giver and the like, and that actually this seems to belie the actual devotion that one has to be an avowed. And I'm wondering if perhaps you struggled with this, or whether women characters are an issue for you or whatnot.
Well, I don't think they're an issue in general, because there are female characters in my other books that women readers have said nice things about. So it's a, I think that in this case, I made a decision that the main characters were going to be this group of four guys who have been thrown together from an early age, and whose job is to ring the bell, but wind the clock every day in their consent. So that's kind of the core group, and the female characters are good friends of theirs, but they're ineluctably kind of outside of that group, and seem because of the first person narrative style. Whenever you see the female characters here, you're seeing them through the eyes of an 18-year-old male, and the way that 18-year-old males look at females, you know, even if they're really enlightened people and nice guys, you know, it's definitely a somewhat distorting lens, let's say.
Often uncivilized, too.
Yeah, and he's pretty civilized, but I guess I don't really see Ayla in quite that way. I think she's got a little more depth than some people are giving her credit for, but I can't argue with people's feelings.
Yeah. Is this the risk, perhaps, of writing a book of ideas that people will sort of look to the character inadequacies, what they see or their own particular feelings, as opposed to concentrate on the ideas or the framing of those ideas in relation to how these characters are and how they're essential to their very being?
Boy, I don't know if I'm going to get much traction on that question. I'm not one to sit around and think about these things a lot. these kind of high level issues while I'm doing it. But you may have a point.
Well, to what degree do you revisit your previous novels, or do you not revisit them at all and just move on to the next one? It seems to me that if you're not always thinking about these, as you call them, higher level ideas or whatnot, that perhaps they don't matter much to you. Or I mean, where do you draw the urge to continue on or to evolve as a writer? Or is it just a matter of just doing it?
It's just doing it. I mean, it's my job. It's I have to do it, or I become unhappy. I like to do it. So there's not a lot of planning involved. There's not a lot of standing back and looking at my career or anything like that. I just kind of put my head down and plow ahead.
I also wanted to ask you one last question. That is about the wiki that you've set up, or someone has set up for this book. I know there was one for the Baroque cycle, and I'm wondering if this supplemental nexus, so to speak, is a way for you to stave off those readers who wish to contact you or who wish to, as you've pointed out in your Why You Are a Bad Correspondent essay on your site, whether this is a way to deflect some of that, or whether this, again, represents what we're talking about here, which is, well, the book's out there, I've done it, I don't really feel the need to dwell on it any more than I have to, and that sort of thing. What of this notion of this conversation?
The wiki got going last week, I think, and it was set up by a reader who just wanted to do it. It wasn't my idea, and I haven't looked at it in a week. The last time I looked at it, had just started up and didn't have much on it, but I suppose I ought to go back and take a look and see how it's developing. It's certainly not a strategy to avoid contact with readers, but it is true that there's when people want to look up information on a topic, it's always better to have that information just out there on the internet so that you can go get it quickly and easily and not have to sort of find someone and ask them. So I think it'll be quite useful in that sense.
In terms of reader contact and reviews, do you pay attention to much of this, or is it again a matter of just writing the books?
Well, yeah, I pay attention. I guess I read reviews that come to my attention, and I have contact with readers through these book tours.
Yeah.
So, I've signed several thousand books and had at least brief conversations with about that many readers in the last week or so on the book tour circuit, and certainly not very deep conversations, but I think enough to take people's temperature and get a sense of what they're thinking.
Well, Neil, it was a pleasure. Thank you for taking the time out to talk. It was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you.
It was a pleasure to do it. Thanks for having me.
Sure.